are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this episode, I talk to William Shaw, founder of The Bookmakers, which is a community bookshop run by writers for writers in the heart of Brighton. I talk to local writer Kathy Hayward about her new book, The Girl in the Maze, out soon with Agora Books. Local bookseller and journalist Caitlin Gleeson speaks to local crime writer Sheila Boogler. And I talk to Brighton-based author of this month's book club book, Afterlove, Tanya Byrne. I am joined by local author and founder of The Bookmakers, William Shaw. William, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
How lovely to be here. Thank you very much.
What is The Bookmakers?
Well, it was during lockdown last year, I was kind of thinking there's going to be a lot of empty shops because there was a lot of retail that was struggling, I thought, everywhere. And I had this idea that what if you took over an empty shop and filled it full of writers? Because Brighton is full of writers. You practically trip over them in the street, don't you? So I thought, what if I take some of those writers and I say, well, here's a bookshop. You can have your books in this bookshop. But in return, will you do something for us? And so right from the beginning, I was teaming up with Creative Future, who are a Brighton-based arts charity who work with underrepresented artists. And one of their big themes is underrepresented writers. They do the big Creative Future Awards in London every year with the London Literature Festival. And I thought that might be a really nice matchup, just simply that. So I got Creative Future involved and they started looking for a premises because they have a bit more heft than me. And it wasn't until this spring that Brighton Council announced this wonderful sort of scheme for artists to move into empty shops. And we put an application on that. And we were lucky to be picked as the kind of flagship venue on that. And it was partly because we had a commercial kind of offer to make into a shop. We weren't just putting, you know, it wasn't just a charity shop. We weren't just putting art into a shop. We were actually trying to sell things to the public. We teamed up with Goldsborough Books, who are a brilliant local independent bookshop who specialise in hardback books. But they sort of got the idea from the start. And, you know, David, who runs it, lives in Brighton. He's a close friend of ours. And he said, well, you know, why don't I provide the stock and I'll underwrite the costs, because there are still significant costs in running any shop, even under an empty shops kind of scheme. You've still got some rates to pay, you've got a lot of electricity and stuff like that, and you've got basic stuff you need to pay for. So they you know, those sort of three partners, me, Creative Future and Goldsborough Books, sort of had this thing, and we've got given this beautiful shop in Cranbourne Street to play with. And it's like fantastic because we've got this wonderful empty premises. And so what we did is we started ordering the books through Goldsborough, putting them on the shelves, and that's basically the start of it.
What authors are you working with to do this? Who are your mentors?
A huge sort of variety of them. There's anything like Mick Finley, who's a historical crime writer. There's Dorothy Coombson, Hove writer, brilliant writer. Ellie Griffiths. Kate Harrison, who writes under the name Eva Carter at the moment. She's working with us. There's 15 of us all together. So I'm beginning to sort of falter on names. So everybody who listens now is going to be really insulted I haven't mentioned them. But yeah, loads of them. I was actually just scrabbling around to try and find my long list of writers before you asked the question and failed to open it in time.
So what does it mean to be working with these authors? So they're on board, you know, what are you getting in return from them?
Well, I'm getting their participation in the shop, like people like Mick Jackson, who's brilliant writer, Brighton-based writer, was longlisted for the Booker a while back. You know, he's there in presence, actually coming and volunteering in the shop, and then also sort of will be mentoring writers. We're teaming them up very carefully with writers. And also we've got their presence. So we can point to the wall as people come into the shop, say, what's all this about? And they point to this wonderful wall of writers and say, well, these are the people who are helping us out in our project. And that's given us the space just to actually have their names attached, allowed us kind of take over the space. And from that, we can then not only do the mentoring, but we can open up the shop to other types of writing. So we've got all sorts of books that, you know, the whole Creative Future approach to sort of broadening the cultural base can sort of be put in there. I mean, I'm really pleased that we sold, like within the first couple of weeks, about a dozen copies of the poetry book Surge by the writer whose name I've currently forgotten. And I might have to come back to you on that. But, you know, what a wonderful thing that you can sell 12 poetry books just like that. Yeah. You know, books by Jared McGuinness, who's coming down to talk to us. All sorts of writers who would be, you know, there's plenty of books like the Galden book and stuff like that we put in there, and they're getting lots of attention, but we're trying to then squeeze in a wider selection of books. On top of that, we've got other Brighton writers, the poor dears who need lots of help from us, like Peter James and CJ Sanson. But also there's lots of brilliant writers in Brighton. We gradually stock their books in there, and then books about writing, because, you know, part of the things we want to do, and was kind of like the original vision of this, is this should be a space that kind of connects writing to bookselling. Because one of the things I always think about is when you're teaching people to write, you very often teach them how to write nice prose, but you don't teach them about the ecology in which they've got to exist. And especially for people who struggle more to get into writing, actually the difficult bit isn't necessarily getting their voice onto the page. The really difficult bit is taking from there into this commercial world, which becomes really restrictive and quite conservative. And that's one of the real problems with book publishing. For all its goodwill, it's a naturally risk-averse environment. So to get your voice heard actually becomes quite hard until you get this huge, great breakthrough that we had with things like the Black Lives Matter movement, and suddenly a whole new voices were being heard. It takes a wave like that to sort of break down perceptions in publishing that there is an audience out there. So by kind of creating this thing in the commercial space, so writers can see how difficult it is to get a book in front of the audience, I'm kind of creating something which I think, you know, expresses the whole chain of what it's like to be a writer. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it does. It does. And I think I'm so on board with anything that makes publishing like more accessible and opens those doors. So this might sound like a stupid question, but when you say mentorship, what does that look like? So say I'm someone in Brighton from an underrepresented group, and I think, right, I've always wanted to write. This is my opportunity. What would I do? And what would that look like?
It would look like, well, first you'd get in touch with Creative Future, because they're managing all the mentees. But what it looks like is like we give people simply three sessions with one of these authors. And I think it's, you know, it can be pretty much on terms. They've got to, in that first session, work out what their parameters are, because a lot of the writers that we're dealing with might not have the experience of some of the other writers who might go on a Curtis Brown creative course or something like that. They might be quite early on in a writing journey because they've felt it's not, you know, they're not allowed. So some of it is just putting them in the presence of those people so they can have conversations about what you need to think of next. And some of them are actually embarked on projects where the writers will then read some of that and feedback on it. So it's very much, I think, with this kind of thing, we've got the luxury of tailor-making it for each individual. But I have to say, you know, cautiously, we're going very cautiously. We haven't got millions of the mentorships set up. We've got, you know, there's half a dozen being done at the moment. And actually, that's kind of thing. Of the project of the 6 months, we want to have all those 15 writers attached to one of those people. And that's what we can do. And it's not like offering everybody everything, but we're trying to work out a model that kind of works, in which the authors volunteering their time can actually communicate meaningfully with these people. And I think partly it's about inclusion. Do you know what I mean? It's about sort of saying, well, okay, you're a writer from a very different sort of area than me, but we're going to talk, we're going to have some ideas. Because I find a lot of the problems with writing is people's misconception of what it takes, or people's unwillingness to give themselves permission to enter the room. You know, so a lot of the conversations might be different from you'd get on a more formal course, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. So you've just launched your events programme. What is happening in September?
Well, it's a really, I think, really lovely mixture of some basic practical writing workshops. There's open writing sessions that New Writing South have kindly set up with us. I'm doing a thing called Silent Write, where you just literally come into the room and you write for an hour. And that's it. And maybe we talk about it afterwards. But then we're doing things like nature journaling for well-being, which is one of the Creative Writing Future workshops, and Creative Future also focusing on this sort of sense of well-being and mental health. In fact, one of the workshops they're doing is Write Yourself to Better Mental Health, and it's about sort of journal taking, note taking, and putting yourself in those scenarios. We've got Jared McGuinness down, as I said. He's going to be talking about his book with Colin Grant, who's also involved in his capacity as Writers Mosaic, which is a writing group he set up to sort of show the sort of mosaic of writers that are in a wider selection of British writing, if that makes any sense. I got Sara Jafari down, who's she's one of the Galden writers. She's going to be talking to Dorothy Coombson about her new book, The Mismatch. And, you know, Ellie Griffiths, who's one of the writers is mentoring, got in touch and said, well, I've got a book out called The Midnight Hour, what if we do a midnight launch for the Midnight Hour? So at 11:45 on the 29th of September, we're going to be opening up and doing a special midnight party for her. We've got Joelle Taylor coming out then at the beginning of October to talk about her poetry book and sort of the whole sort of poems around gender and sexuality. What else? We've got Peter James. Peter James coming in. We have to have Peter James. He's coming in to do a book signing on 11th of October. Nadine Matheson's coming down after that. Great writer, newly sort of really emerged this year, crime writer. And a woman I talked to on, I do a thing called Reading Party where people read aloud together. And I did this woman called Ali Afzal. And she was just brilliant. So I've got her down to talk about her book. Yeah, and then Vaseem Khan, who's been absolutely brilliant in this. Vaseem Khan's a sort of mate of mine from the crime writing fraternity. And he came in and he's actually came down and worked for a day in the bookshop earlier on in the month and sold loads of his books. It was amazing. It was just brilliant. But he's going to come down. He's been doing some research into kind of identity and publishing. With particular sort of stuff about diversity and the diversity report that the Publishers Association published, had some fairly shocking stuff. You know, it's about the well-meaning people like us who blunder into this stuff. And sometimes we need a little bit of talking to about what we think we're doing. So he's going to be doing another talk about that, which is a one with Colin Grant. And that's on the 3rd of November. Loads. My old editor, Rose Tomaszewska, now is senior editor at Virago. She's coming down to talk about publishing.
Oh, this actually sounds excellent. I'm so excited and will definitely be coming down. So do you think that writers inherently can sell more of their books themselves by hand? Do you think that's just a fact? That if a writer is in the shop with a pile of their books, they can flog them better than anyone else?
Do you know, one thing I've really learned about books, that when I used to go into a bookshop as a kid and sort of all that, I used to go into a bookshop almost to be alone and to be on my own and take a book and just read it on my own. Books have changed completely. Something about social media changed the whole meaning of books, and books now are about a community and who you can draw in, who you know's read that book. And actually that goes right back to the duty on the author, and the author is kind of part of that community now. If you read a book, they don't have to be, you can be a self-killed author and stay on your own in your garret, but I think authors are now part of that community of people who read their books and ought to be, I think, willing to engage in that conversation. So if you're there in the shop and you buy it, I think a lot of people quite like that. They see the writer there and it works. Doesn't necessarily work for me when I try and sell my books, but more charming writers than me seem to do very well when they come down to the bookshop and sell.
So if someone's listening and they're thinking, I'm a writer in Brighton, I want my book in the Bookmakers, I want to get involved, what can they do?
Well, firstly, the best thing to do is come down. There's a little desk there, and it's got a sign above it saying writer at work. Come and work at that desk. Just come and sit there. And if you've got a book out, maybe we can stick your book on the desk, and maybe you can sort of hand sell your own book. We've got a kind of problem in that we can't take, you know, Brighton is so full of writers. We can't take everything. And, you know, very often self-publishing is a problem, not because of the quality of self-published books, but just because of the chain by which we get them. I've been really sort of definite about this. We're working in partnership with Goldsborough. Goldsborough are underwriting our costs. They're kind of making this possible. So we have to sell books we can get through them. And if we can't order them through them, we can't really stock them. But we're trying to. We're gradually building up more and more local writers. But, you know, I'd say on any day I'm there, three or four writers come in and say, I've got a book out. I think writers need to be aware of what that it feels like as a bookshop owner, because if we took all them on, we'd be drowning our work. And the one thing we can't do, sadly, is just say, yeah, we'll take your books and we'll stock them ourselves, because our accounting would look horrible for a start. We'd have to tot up the maths on every single book. And, you know, my maths is crap. My writing's pretty poor, but my maths is shocking.
Well, thank you so much for coming in, William. And I actually picked up our next book club book at the Bookmakers the other day, which is called Wounding by local author Heidi James. So, William, how can we find and follow you and the Bookmakers? And what's going to happen after 6 months?
Well, after 6 months, I'm going to go to sleep for a bit, because it's a hell of a lot of work, actually. It's been lovely and it's very exciting. But I can remember speaking to Jane at Creative Future when we decided to go to this, thinking, oh, crap, that's our year dealt with. And it certainly is. You know, I hope something goes on with this project, but it might, you know, I'd like to pass it on somewhere. I think, you know, bookshops have been brilliant about understanding community and have actually shown how high streets can survive. I think this is yet another wrinkle on that sort of thing. And I'd love there to be more models like this. How can you find it? Well, we're at the_bookmakers on Twitter. We're at the underscore book underscore makers on Instagram. And I think you can find us on Facebook and stuff like that. We should be pretty findable. 1516 Cranbourne Street, just near Churchill Square, if you walk down those steps.
Excellent. Thank you so much, William.
Thank you.
I am joined by local writer Kathy Hayward, who is the author of The Girl in the Maze, which is out in October. Kathy, welcome.
Hi, Anne. I'm really pleased to be here.
What is this book about?
So this book is about three generations of women and the trauma that kind of rolls down from generation to generation. So it starts with the protagonist, Emma, who is clearing out her mother's flat after she's died. And she finds something which helps to explain the difficult relationship that they had. And then she kind of goes more and more into it and finds out a whole thing about her mother's history and past. And it really helps to, I guess it's a sort of therapy. It helps her to understand her relationship with her mother and to make sure that she doesn't make the same mistakes with her children.
And where did the inspiration come from?
So it is slightly autobiographical, as in I had a very difficult relationship with my mother, and I got the inspiration when I was clearing out her flat after she died. I didn't find anything which explained our difficult relationship, but I think writing the story really helped, was kind of a form of therapy, I guess, in itself. And so I now feel quite at peace with the relationship I had with my mum, and in fact the book is dedicated to her as a result.
I'd love to know a bit more about your writing process, because you're a journalist by trade, is that right? How did you kind of make that transition from journalism into fiction and writing a novel?
Okay, I kind of went in a roundabout kind of route. So I was a journalist for 13 years, writing from some quite niche business publications. And then I went to completely the other side and I set up a PR agency, and so went into the sort of the dark side of PR, which I have had great fun, and that's like 10 years ago. And then I think during that time, I perhaps missed some of the creativity, because even when you're a journalist, I was doing quite long form features at times, and you can be quite creative. And I kind of missed that. And so I guess about 5 years ago, I started writing The Girl in the Maze. So I think, yeah, it was a roundabout way into creative writing.
And you did a course with Brighton-based New Writing South. Would you recommend that to anyone that's looking to get their novel written?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think I would be here with a book about who published if it hadn't been for those guys. It was a two-year course I started, I think, in 2015. It was part-time in the evenings, one evening a week with the occasional weekend course. It's called the Creative Writing Programme. And it's absolutely brilliant. Not only did I meet a really great group of local writers, but also it kind of set me on the track of, I was writing in lots of different styles and genres, and just gave me a huge amount of confidence. And then I think later in the second year, I kind of realized that what I was writing wasn't distinct little bits and pieces for different exercises we were told to do, but was kind of part of a greater whole, and that really became The Girl in the Maze. So it was a real springboard for me for writing the book.
Now, I know that you're going to read some for us now. Can you set the context at the beginning of the book?
Okay, so the book it's in dual time zone. So it starts in 1937 and it's also in the present day, or 2019. So it's all pre-pandemic. But it starts in 1937 in the character of Betty. And you hear three voices in the book. It's Betty, her granddaughter, Emma, who's the main protagonist, and then also Jack, who is Betty's husband. Betty lay in the bath, her white legs flushing a blotchy pink in the scorching water. The passage light leaked through the edges of the bathroom door, merging into the glow from the street lamp, fractured through the frosted glass window. The mirror perspired in the heat, dripping into the basin. She took another gulp from the half-empty bottle balanced on the corner of the bath, where the mould bred between the tiles. Her face twisted at the gin's bitter burn. But the bottle was cool against her cheek as she pulled a breath into her tight lungs. Her mother's knitting needle balanced on the cloth used to wipe her sisters' faces. As she leant forward to feel the pointed tip again with her finger, the water sloshed over the sides of the bath, striking the floor beneath. The muffled sounds of her sisters finishing off their tea in the kitchen next door mingled with her mother's muted scolding. There wasn't much time. The hum of buses grinding up Battersea Park Road past St Saviour, blurred with the shouts of the men clocking off, heading to the pub, and the yelling of the boys playing football by the dim streetlights. She reached forward over the growing tightness of her belly and grasped a knitting needle, then let it float on the surface of the scalding water, and it sunk beneath the waterline, turning almost gaily downwards. The intense heat made her drowsy. It was difficult to move. Angry steps sounded. "You've taken all my bleeding hot water. There ain't none left." Her mother was at the door, shaking the handle. "What are you doing in there?" "I won't be long, Ma." "Least you could do is be here helping me with this lot, not dilly-dallying in there. Betty, I'll be there in a minute." "Bloody hurry up, cheek taking all that water. Nothing for your Pa when he gets home." The sound of steps moved away, and Betty imagined her mother, her thin, faded housecoat wrapped around her ample frame, stomping back into the tiny front room. There was a shout from next door, the sound of a child being slapped and then whimpering. The knitting needle had settled, resting across the dark mound of her pubic hair. She stared at it. One small movement. Over. Quick.
A tiny little round of applause. That is such an amazing opening. I'd love to know, so you said that that this is inspired by your life, basically. How did you deal with the ethical implications of doing that, and kind of respecting people that no longer were alive to have their voices heard, and making sure that you were true to yourself at the same time?
Okay, well, I think one of the things about The Girl in the Maze is you never hear Margaret's story. Margaret is a sort of fictional account of my mother. And I felt that in her life, no one really heard her story. And she kind of touched on it now and again in her life. She talked about things that had happened. But I think as a child, sometimes you're not that interested in your parents' lives before they're born, or indeed at all. And so I never really followed up with a lot of what happened. And she'd had a really quite traumatic life. And so I think through the book, I'm giving her a voice that perhaps she wouldn't have had. And everyone in the book has died. I don't have any relatives apart from my children and a very aged aunt who's on the other side of the family who doesn't know about the book. So I don't feel I'm kind of going against any sort of family issues. And it is fiction. Although there's the odd bit of fact in there, it's largely fiction. So I don't have any concerns on that front.
I would love to know about your process of getting published. Did you know much about the industry before you kind of embarked on this?
No, not at all. I wrote the story because I just wanted to write this story. And once I think when I started the course with the creative writing program, I wanted to write a book. But I didn't know anything about the publishing process. And I just kind of started writing, and we'd done a little bit on structure in the course, or quite a lot on structure in the course. And so I started putting it together. And then I think I'd got to just before the pandemic really started, and I had a kind of really rough first draft. And I gave it to one of my tutors who'd agreed to look at it. And then she came back to me kind of in the early months of the pandemic with some suggestions for not significant changes, and so from that I made a second draft, and then she helped me again get a third draft, which is a little bit more polished, and then I went out into the world and tried to sell it.
And you did, and it's coming out soon, and that's quite a fast turnaround in the very slow world of publishing.
Isn't it slow? I had no idea how slow it was. But then suddenly it's really rapid. So I didn't hear anything for months and months and months once I'd got my publishing deal. And then suddenly, all in the space of like 6 weeks, it's all happening. I'm getting daily messages from my editor and stuff. So yeah, it's a really crazy world.
It's very, very exciting. And congratulations. So what is next for you?
So I've since written a second book. So I finished writing The Girl in the Maze in June 2020, and then I had a bit of a break over the summer while I went out to loads of agents and publishers and tried to get a deal, but by the autumn I'd really missed writing, and so I started writing a second book, which is called The Fortune Teller's Promise, and that's set in Brighton in the Great War, and my publisher is looking at that at the moment, and I'm currently writing a third book, which is also, it's set in Brighton in the 1970s and also in Berwick-upon-Tweed in the present day. So yeah, and that's all about a woman who suffers from postnatal psychosis, So I like really hardcore topics, and which can be quite grim sometimes, but all about mothering and motherhood and women, really.
Absolutely wonderful. So how can we find and follow you and pre-order a copy of The Girl in the Maze?
I use Twitter quite a lot at @KathyHayward7. I'm also on Instagram @Kathy_Hayward_writer. And I have a fledgling website, which is kathyhayward.co.uk.
Today, I'm speaking with author Sheila Bugler to chat about her new crime novel, The Lucky Eight. The Lucky Eight is set in Brighton and the surrounding area and starts off with a suspicious murder on the beach. Thank you for joining me today, Sheila.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate, and I'm delighted to be here and talk about my book.
And so your novel centres around the eight survivors of a plane crash and the people closest to them. It begins when one of the survivors is discovered dead on the beach. Tell us about the first idea that you had that started the writing of this book.
So I had this idea, and for all of my books, they always start with a single idea. And for this book, I just had this idea of a group of people who'd survived a plane crash. And I was really interested in that kind of special bond between very different people who've survived something, who have a common experience of a very traumatic event. So I was really interested in kind of exploring that dynamic of the relationship between those people. And that was really the starting point. I didn't have anything more than that. So that was the starting point. And then from there, the novel eventually became The Lucky Eight.
Great. And one of the main survivors, Claudia, suffers memory loss and can be something of an unreliable narrator as you read the book. What kind of research did you undertake to write that kind of complex part of her character?
So I did quite a bit of research. Now, my own background is I studied psychology at university, and I did a master's years later, and a part of my master's, my real kind of interest in... Well, obviously, I'm interested in human behaviour because I studied psychology, but I'm also really interested in neurology and sort of the workings of the brain and stuff. And I was really wary, actually, about having a character with brain injury, because it can become a kind of common trope,
yeah,
in crime fiction especially. So I did a lot of research into the type of brain damage she would have and the type of cognitive processing problems, which is specifically what she has. She has things like, for example, if she's cooking and she has to follow a recipe, because if she's not following a recipe, she'll kind of forget what she's meant to be doing and stuff.
Okay.
So I did, I wouldn't say I did loads of research, but I did as much as I could to make sure that I didn't get it wrong, really.
Yeah, of course, to be sensitive to that kind of
experience.
Absolutely. Exactly. And there's quite a few celebrity characters in the book. You've got Nick, Vivian, Adam. Did you draw influence from real life celebrities, or did you just sort of pick the common tropes from each and kind of mix them all together?
I think one of the things about The Lucky Eight is there's kind of loads of different types of crime fiction. You know, we've got police procedurals, we've got psychological thrillers, and also there's the kind of classic whodunits like the Agatha Christie books. And I was very clear early on with this book that I wanted it to be almost a modern twist on a classic whodunit.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about the whodunit books, typically, if you think of Agatha Christie particularly, there's always a host of glamorous characters who on the surface, they look like they have everything, but actually they're all harbouring dark secrets underneath.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons for having those kind of celebrities as characters. And also, I just think as in the 21st century, I'm really interested in the difference between the sort of adulation we give celebrities and actually, you know, the fact that they're just real people like everyone else.
Mm.
So that they're, none of them are based on any particular real person, but obviously they're kind of, I suppose, based on my collective perception of the way we view celebrities in the media generally.
Excellent. And your detective, so there's a couple of detectives in the book. The main one that we sort of get familiar with is Detective Rachel Lewis. She's solving this as her first major case. What kind of process is involved in learning about how a murder procedural goes and what is the day-to-day life of a detective?
Oh, goodness, that's such a good question, because the process is painful, Caitlin.
No.
You have to, because... And actually, with everything to do with crime fiction, there is a real responsibility to do your research properly.
Of course.
So with Rachel, with all the police procedural side of things, my first series of books was a police procedural series. So I was living in London then, and I got a lot of help from the local police in Lewisham, where I lived. Mm-hmm. And for Rachel, actually, what I did was a friend of mine here in Eastbourne is a retired detective. So I basically, as I wrote the book, I just collated a whole list of questions and I sent them to her, and she kind of came back and sort of put anything that was wrong, she made sure it was right.
Oh,
and I'm
fantastic.
Sure I still got things wrong, you know, but it was her input was really valuable, actually.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. So you had kind of on call help with any questions you had.
I did. And actually with this book, the other thing that was really important to me, and I think probably predominantly important for me, was because I was describing a plane crash, I felt really, really that I couldn't just kind of do that without sort of getting help, you know.
Yeah.
For loads of obvious reasons, I had to make sure that I got that side of things right. So I managed to find an ex-pilot, and
wow,
he was amazing, actually. He really helped not only with getting the technical details right, but also in terms of plotting the novel, sort of things that would be possible if somebody was flying a plane and things that wouldn't be possible. And that, like, he was just amazing, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, I did, with this book more than any of the others I've written, I actually relied really heavily on kind of expert advice.
That's very, very cool. And are you a fan of crime stories yourself? Like, would you be the first person to sit down and watch the new Line of Duty episode, or do you prefer?
Yeah, I know a lot of crime writers, and I can't imagine you'd ever find a crime writer who says they don't like crime fiction, or
yeah,
if they do, I can't imagine that they're a good crime writer, basically. I absolutely am obsessed with crime fiction. I read crime fiction almost, you know, I read crime fiction more than I read anything else. I kind of immerse myself in the genre, and I think it's really important, because I think you have to understand the genre that you're writing in, and you have to understand I think really importantly, you need to understand where your work fits within the massive kind of scope of crime fiction. It's a huge area. There's so many different types of crime fiction. And I think you need to know the genre you're writing in. So, yes, I read loads of crime fiction, and I watch loads of crime fiction on TV as well, definitely.
Yeah. And speaking of, like, other crime fiction, Peter James has obviously famously set his Roy Grace detective series in Brighton. What do you think it is about Brighton that lends itself to crime writing?
Well, I think Brighton, I mean, it's just such a great city, and it's got so much, because, you know, Ellie Griffiths, her second series, the sort of one set in the 50s, that they're set in Brighton as well, and she says that it really is quite a magical city. It's got so much history, and it's just got it's got its own really kind of sense of self and its own character. So I just think it's a great place. And I definitely, with this book, I wasn't trying to take over from Peter James. And actually, most of my novels are set in Eastbourne, where I live.
Yeah.
But with this, part of it with this was that because it was a standalone novel, I didn't want to set it in Eastbourne. And I actually wanted to set this novel in Ireland. But in the end, because I live in Sussex and I'm very drawn to Sussex at the moment, it ended up being a Sussex novel. But I chose Brighton more than anything to move it away from Eastbourne, if I'm honest, you know.
And what is it about Sussex in particular that influences you?
So I'm obviously Irish for my accent. I've lived in many, many different places around the world. But in my late 20s, early 30s, I settled in London and I got married. I had two kids, and I was really, really desperate after a few years to move out of the city and move closer to countryside. So we ended up moving to Eastbourne kind of by chance, really, because it had the sea and it was just about commutable to London. But actually, we've been here now for 9 years, and I just think I think Sussex is an amazingly beautiful county. You know, I live, I'm talking to you now, I can look out my window and I can see the South Downs.
Yeah.
I can walk to the beach from where I live. I just think it's really, really kind of very beautiful and very special, and
absolutely,
I'm completely in love with it.
Yes, absolutely. I think everybody who lives kind of in East Sussex, West Sussex would agree.
Yeah.
And so for potential readers, so they can get a feel of your novel, I would love to hear some of the novel if you'd like to read to us.
Sure, of course. Okay, well, so the opening bit of the novel starts with just a kind of bit about the plane crash, which I'm not going to read. I'm going to go straight into the next scene, which is when Clodagh is on the beach 5 years after the crash. So here we go. Clodagh squeezed her eyes shut and breathed slowly, counting each breath the way she'd been taught, forcing her mind to focus on nothing except the rise and fall of her diaphragm. It's okay, she whispered. But it wasn't okay, because when she opened her eyes, the body was still there, exactly where it had been when she first saw it. His head twisted sideways at an odd angle from the rest of his body. Black blood pooled beneath his crushed skull. More blood splattered over the shingle beach. Too much blood. A sound came out of her mouth, somewhere between a moan and a wail as it hit her, finally, that he was dead. No, 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 no. She ran towards him, then stopped. She remembered enough from crime novels and TV programs to know she shouldn't touch a dead body. She scanned the beach, desperate to see another person out here. Someone strong and reliable, like Clodagh herself had once been, who would take over and make cups of tea and tell her that everything was going to be all right. But apart from Clodagh, the dead man and a squalling squabble of seagulls skimming the surface of the water, the beach was empty. So still and silent, it was easy to believe no one else would ever come here and disrupt the quiet of this lonely place. A pink line on the horizon, where the sky met water, announced the start of a new day. This was the reason she'd come onto the beach, to watch the sunrise. Now she barely noticed it as her mind went back over the previous day and evening. They'd had the memorial service in the afternoon. Sad and moving, but uplifting too. The feeling of a community she only felt when they came together as a group. The sharp reminder of the fragility of life. Knowing how lucky they were to be here. The pain and guilt as they remembered the 160 people who had died. Then later, there were dinner and drinks and more drinks. A single memory stood out from the blur of all the others. The dizzying lurch of fear when she'd read his text message. Meet me outside now. We need to talk. Was that why he died, she wondered? Because he'd been out here, waiting for her? He'd been drunk. Falling over drunk. She tried to picture him coming out here in the dark, stumbling over the stones and falling backwards. Except there was something about that image that didn't work. In her mind, every time he stumbled, he fell forward. But he was lying on his back now, his dead eyes staring up at her. The scar on his left cheek pale and silver in the early morning light. It didn't seem right after everything he'd been through that he was dead. He was a survivor, like her. There were 8 of them in total. Everyone else in the plane that day had died. Clodagh remembered the moment she realised she wasn't the only one. She'd woken up in hospital, dazed and disorientated, with no idea where she was or how she'd got there. When she tried to remember, her mind was a blank. She knew something bad had happened, but the memory of it was gone, along with so much else, although she didn't realise that until much later. There was a TV on the wall opposite her bed. 8 photos on the screen and a man's voice, low and serious, speaking about the terrible tragedy. A sudden shock of recognition tinged with fear when she saw her own face on the screen with some letters beneath it. At first the letters didn't mean anything, but gradually her brain worked out that the letters spelled her name. There were names beneath each of the photos, including the one next to hers. His face on the TV looked nothing like his face now. On the TV he looked happy and bursting with life. And running across the bottom of the screen was the headline that would come to define them. The Lucky 8, the survivors of 975. Clodagh had no idea back then that the phrase would become so widespread that the only people who never used it when talking about the crash were the survivors themselves. And after today, no one else would be using it either, because now there were only 7 of them.
That is brilliant. And I can say I've got about 4 chapters left, and it's an absolute page turner. So for anyone who's listening, for anyone who's intrigued, it's definitely worth the read. If you're a fan of crime writing, it's definitely worth the read.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Sheila. It's been an absolute pleasure. And for anyone who's looking to read the book, it's out now. It's available in all good bookstores, and I would definitely encourage you to go and read it.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Our book club book this month is After Love by local author Tanya Byrne. This is a dark yet uplifting young adult novel exploring mortality, friendship and first love set in Brighton. I absolutely loved this book and raced through it in a few days. I especially loved all the references to Brighton. There are well-drawn characters. It's a book that has moments of light and dark, and it's ultimately really, really hopeful, despite what you might think by reading the blurb. It's definitely a very redemptive read and was an absolute joy and a pleasure to get stuck into. This is why I am so excited to be joined by the author herself, Tanya Byrne. Tanya, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words about my book. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
Give an introduction to yourself as a writer.
My name's Tanya Byrne. I grew up in London, spent 40 years there, and then moved to Brighton it'll be 4 years, August Bank Holiday weekend. So I'm still kind of new to Brighton, but it's starting to feel like home now. I used to work for the BBC. I worked in BBC Radio for about 8 years. So I worked for Radio 1, Radio 3 and Radio 4. And then I left to write my first book, which was published in 2012. And now here I am 4 books later, writing about lesbian grim reapers.
What is After Love about?
After Love is the story of Poppy and Ash, who meet one day on a school trip and fall hopelessly in love. So the book is split into before and after, hence After Love. So in the before section, it's about their love story, about how they meet and go on their first date and their second date and just basically stomp around Brighton, claiming it as their own. They find their own little favourite cafe and, you know, they go to Snoop's Paradise. And yeah, so it's all about their love story. And then on New Year's Eve, Ash sneaks out to a party on the beach, which he wasn't supposed to do. And when her mum finds out, in her haste to get home, she's hit by a car and killed. And the legend goes that the last person to die on New Year's Eve becomes the Grim Reaper for their parish. So Ash becomes the Grim Reaper for Brighton, and she is assigned adolescent sudden deaths, which is the way that she passed away. And she's based in a bookshop in the lanes with a woman called Deborah, who, and I quote, knows everything and tells them nothing. And then two other Grim Reapers about her age called Essen and Dev. And basically it's their job to escort the newly dead down to the beach where the ferryman is waiting to take them wherever it is that they're going. So they describe themselves as glorified cab drivers for the recently dead, because that's all they do. They're basically sitting around the bookshop waiting for someone to die. And then Ash sees Poppy again and she's thrilled. But then she realises that perhaps it isn't such a good thing that she sees Poppy again. So the story is basically about how they get an ending to their story, which they didn't have before.
Where did the kind of lesbian Grim Reaper concept come to you?
Well, I actually, the Grim Reaper concept was one that I actually had for my second book. So I wanted to write a book about a teen Grim Reaper, but it wasn't really on brand because my first book was like a crime thriller thing. So I put it in a drawer, and then 6 years ago, my mum passed away. And after that, I was like, no, I'm not going to write again. That's it. And that's when I moved to Brighton and, you know, got a dog and got a job. And I was like, that's it, I'm done. But writing is one of those things that even if you're not being published, you still do it. And my way of dealing with things or processing things is to write through it. So I kind of initially set out to write a book about grief. And then while I was writing it, I remembered this idea for my second book that I'd put in a drawer, because I just kept thinking about what is it that you want when you lose someone and you just want one more day with them, to kind of say goodbye or say all those things that you didn't get a chance to say while they were still here. And that's where the Grim Reaper thing came into it. And then, you know, it's me, I'm queer, so I always put lesbians in everything. So it became a lesbian story.
Can you read some for us and give us a bit of context?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So just to give you a little bit of context for this scene, the story revolves around Poppy and Ash, who have just met on a school trip to Rampion Wind Farm. If you're from Brighton, then you must see them, see the farm out at sea. which isn't exactly the most sexy meet cute ever, but it is what it is. And so they've just met, and I'm just going to read a little bit about kind of how Ash feels about that moment. We're talking so much that we miss the discussion about the wonders of renewable energy, which means that I will almost certainly fail next week's test, but I'm struggling to give even half a shit because I want to ask her everything. I know that her name is Poppy Morgan and she's 16 like me, and she's just started at Rodine after being kicked out of another super posh boarding school called Wycombe Abbey. I know that she likes to twist a ponytail around her hand when she talks, that she presses her lips together when she's thinking, and that she's okay with open water, but she doesn't like heights. It's not enough, though. I want to know if she has any brothers or sisters and what her favourite song is so I can go home and listen to it on repeat. But it's also perfect. It feels like she and I are encased in a soap bubble that will pop if I'm foolish enough to do anything to disturb it. So I don't say a word, painfully aware that a clock is ticking somewhere at the shoreline, as the shoreline gets closer and closer. And it's like I'm floating, like I've left my body and I'm looking down at us, standing on the deck of the boat, and God, it's perfect. The sky is so big, I want to see every corner of it. I tell myself, well, beg myself actually, not to overthink it, to just enjoy these last few moments. But the clock is tick, tick, ticking, and the shoreline is getting closer and closer, and I'm waiting. Waiting for the bubble to burst, because it always does. She's so near that I can feel the heat of her next to me, and I warn myself not to make more of it than it is. I haven't done this often, but I've done it often enough to know how this ends. All the girls in the rainbow t-shirts who kiss girls to impress boys, but would die if anyone called them a dyke. The girls with the careless smiles and thirsty hearts who draw lines that only they can see and move goalposts when I'm not looking. All those things said and unsaid, never to be spoken of again. All the times I said, okay, when I really wanted to say, I don't want to be friends. The ghost girls who were there, then not there, who let themselves give in to that itch of curiosity, just for a moment, and make me feel something, only to conclude that it isn't for them. The ones who were bored or scared or both, who'd rather tell me that they were drunk than let me know that they felt something as well, because all they want is a quiet life. Someone they can love without it being brave. Someone they can invite over for Sunday lunch and go to prom with. I am the first and last and nothing in between. The mad one, the wild one. The one who sees things that aren't there. I am to be unloaded on, to be bled on and cried all over. I am the one they experiment with. The one they can let go with because I'll never tell. I'm the one they have saved in their phone as Alfie or Luke or Harry. The keeper of secrets and the soother of guilt, but I'm never the one. I'm not to be loved, not out loud anyway. Maybe one day if I'm lucky, I'll be a what if, or worse, the one before the one that made them realise that it wasn't just a phase. But for the most part, I will be barely a footnote in the book of that quiet life that they want so much. And as I stand beside Poppy looking out at the wide, wild sea, I wait. Wait for her to move away when one of the Rodine girls approaches, or to suddenly mention a boyfriend, like this is nothing, like all she's doing is talking, like all, that's all this is, just talking. After all, even fear becomes a habit after a while, doesn't it? We're approaching the marina, and this is it, I know. The moment has passed. The pain in my chest is so keen that it brings tears to my eyes as I make myself look down at the water so Poppy doesn't see as the boat pulls in. When I do, I notice that the water is a different colour here, a colour I've only ever seen in postcards from other people. Poppy must notice as well, because she says that we could be in the Côte d'Azur. She says it with a dreamy sigh, and when she closes her eyes, she suddenly feels very far away, even though she's standing right next to me. The nearest I've ever been to the French Riviera, or France in general, is a croissant from the Real Patisserie, and it's as close as I'm ever likely to get. But for whatever reason, our paths cross today. Call it luck or fate or good old-fashioned magic. And they're about to part, never to cross again. I mean, it's not like I'm going to bump into her at Lidl or waiting for the 1A, is it? This is it, I know, as the boat docks. She'll just be that girl I think about sometimes when I look out at the wind farm or when I eat a croissant. Here, Poppy says. She takes the phone out of my hand, so suddenly I don't have a chance to object. When she gives it back, I look at the screen to find that she's added her number to my contacts. if you ever feel like jumping, she says, the corner of her mouth twitching mischievously when I look up again, or a coffee. My chest hurts for a different reason this time, because I want to see her again. I really want to see her again. And she wants to see me, and that never happens. I don't know what to say, so I just smile back and she winks at me. I watch her turn and walk away, her hips swinging and her hair ablaze. And I wonder if there are words for how this feels, but I don't know what they are yet.
Oh, you write the intensity of that first love so beautifully. I can feel it like in every inch of me. It's so, so wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you. So Brighton plays a really vivid role in this book.
Yes.
Like you said, from the wind farm to Rodine to the Bluebird Tea Company, which I also love, and Snooper's Paradise. Were you always going to set it here?
Well, because of this, the way that the Grim Reaper world works, essentially they're not Grim Reapers in the traditional sense. They don't decide that someone's going to die, or they don't touch you and then you die. It's more of a case that they're just told a name, a location and a time, and they just go meet the soul and then escort them to the beach where the ferryman is waiting with a boat to take them wherever it is that they're going. So I knew I needed to be near water for that to happen, and of course Brighton made the perfect setting for that, being near the sea, and it also gave me an excuse to kind of write about my new home that I was, you know, falling in love with myself. So yeah, it definitely is another character in the book, I think. And I was also keen to write about Brighton in the winter off season, so it's not all sunshine and fish and chips on the beach and pride flags. It's very much the Brighton, what it's like to live here all year round, rather than just coming for a holiday or coming for the weekend.
Yes, Brighton in the winter is a completely different character.
It is. When I moved here, someone said, if you can love Brighton in the winter, you'll love it all year round. And that's so true.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an endurance test, though. Mm-hmm. I'm doing about 30 myself.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about being a writer in Brighton? Have you found yourself, I mean, it's difficult because, I mean, about half the time you've been here, we've been locked in, really.
Yes, we've been in lockdown for most of it, yeah.
But there is a large community of writers in Brighton. Have you engaged with this at all?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to move here. When I decided to leave London, I had a couple of choices, Edinburgh, Manchester, and I was thinking about Margate for a while because I did want to be by the sea. But there's something about Brighton that, you know, what I love about it here, I live in Kemptown and everyone seems to have a side hustle. Like everyone was in a band or writes scripts or writes books. And it's a very creative place. Everyone is very accepting of that. Whereas where I used to live in Surrey, it was very kind of middle class, middle management. You know, I was the weird one with my purple hair and my leopard skin coat. People would stare at me. Whereas in Brighton, no one even looks twice. I'm relatively normal.
Oh yeah, you're a bit bland for Brighton.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and what's next for you, Tanya? What are you working on now?
I am actually working on another YA novel that's due at the end of the month. I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's another book for teenagers, and it's essentially Lord of the Rings for teenagers, because I wanted to write a book about, I didn't want to write a pandemic book, but I did want to acknowledge what these teenagers have been through for the last like 18 months or so. I don't think, so for a long time I was like, I don't really want to commit it to art, you know, it is what it is, but actually I think it would be, as a writer, to do a disservice to teenagers to not at least acknowledge what they've been through. So basically it's about this professor that's doing a social experiment in the Brecon Beacons and sticks all these teenagers in a house and tells them it's a digital detox. So they're basically 3 weeks without their phones and the internet. But what they actually find out that she is studying conflict resolution. So she basically wants them to, well, kill each other because they're not on TikTok, and to try and find ways to resolve it. And they find out quite early on, because they're teenagers and very resourceful, and they actually sneak out to a party in the woods, and that's how they find out about it. And so it's about how they as sick of adult shit, basically, and after the last 18 months of realizing that actually no one knows what they're doing, everything's a mess, they're about to inherit a world that's literally on fire, because this is set like now, so it's set like in late July, August, and you know the ocean was literally on fire a couple of weeks ago, and they've just had enough, so they decide to take control of the experiment and turn it on the adults.
Oh my god, that sounds so good. I cannot wait to read that.
It's very different from Afterlife. I'm a bit concerned because I'm just like, everyone loves the love story in it, and there will be sapphic elements, obviously, because it's me, but it's definitely more to do with empowering teenagers and just letting them know that they are seen, and that's all my books are about, really, is letting teenagers know that they're seen, that they're understood, and just acknowledging the fact that they have survived something, really, as much as we have. They've survived something, and not only have they done that, but they've sat GCSEs and tried to fall in love, and you know, all the things that teenagers go through anyway. But on top of that, they're inheriting a world that is a mess, basically, and no one seems to acknowledge that. And this is to think that if you just pull your bootstraps up, you'll be fine, and or just do some meditation or yoga or drink more water. And then also the whole point of the book is that, you know, they didn't create this digital world that they're now part of, and yet they're being berated for being on their phones. They didn't want to be stuck in the house for a year doing Zoom school, but they were. And you know, last year it was like I really felt that young people were really being blamed for the fact that we kept going into lockdown. It wasn't their fault, you know. Yeah, so I just wanted to write something that, as I said, my books are always about being teenagers being seen and understood, and I also wanted to empower them and let them know that they don't need to put up with adult shit, because we don't know what we're doing. I think we've more than proved that in the last
absolutely I know, if I know anything, that's who I know. No one's got a clue.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for coming on, Tanya. How can we find and follow you and buy a copy of your books?
Right, so I am on social media, so my website's tanyaburn.com, and for Instagram and Twitter, it's just Tanya Byrne. And the books are available in all good bookshops. So Amazon, Waterstones, your local indie, Foils. So do go out. And then obviously a shout out to all the local bookshops. So Kemptown Books, City Books, The Book Nook, The Feminist Bookshop, and also Book Matters, which is a new pop-up that's just opened up in town. So there's loads of lovely bookshops that you can support. And please do. And then Waterstones Brighton have been really supportive as well. They've put it in the window, and the last time I went in there, it was actually sold out. So they've been brilliant. So I just want to say a huge thank you to all the indies and to Waterstones in Brighton and Hove for being so supportive.
Thank you for listening to the Brighton Book Club, and thank you to Nigel Stewart for sponsoring this episode. Nigel is an author from Lancashire whose recent book, The Lines Between Lies, is out now and available on Amazon. You can follow him on Twitter at @MeNigeStew, NigeStew. Our next book club book is Wounding by local author Heidi James, out now with Blue Moose Books. The Book Club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at BTN Book Club and email us at btnbookclub@gmail.com. If you're interested in sponsoring an episode, get in touch, and we'll see you next month.